when you're coming from outside government, trying to deal within the government confines can be very, very difficult.
The Alaska delegation voices reservations over President Obama's Interior Secretary pick. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, February 6th. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a settlement aimed at ending cruise industry kickbacks.
If you pay money, they'll pitch your business in a favorable light and, you know, steer customers your way.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
President Barack Obama nominated REI Chief Executive Sally Jewell to lead the Department of the Interior today. It's a cabinet position with incredible influence over Alaska. And by virtually every account, the pick surprised everyone. APRN's Peter Granitz has reactions to the unexpected nominee from Washington.
The Department of Interior oversees critical programs in Alaska, the Bureaus of Indian Affairs and Land Management, the National Park Service, and the offices that promote and regulate offshore drilling. In his announcement, Mr. Obama rattled off a long list of accomplishments outgoing Secretary Ken Salazar has achieved, including opening more land and water to energy production. And now the president turns to another person from the West, Sally Jewell, to continue on that path. She comes from the private sector and the Seattle region.
I'm willing to bet that she will be the first Secretary of the Interior who frequently hikes Mailbox Peak in her native Washington state and who once spent a month climbing mountains in Antarctica, which is just not something I'd think of doing. Because it seems like it'd be cold. And I was born in Hawaii.
Jewell's name had not been publicly floated. Most of the names circulating for the post came from within the Interior Department or other parts of government. Senator Lisa Murkowski says Jewell's private sector background would lend a healthy perspective to the department, but the transition to a massive government bureaucracy could be hard.
When you're coming from outside government, trying to deal within the government confines can be very, very difficult. Secretary Chu is a perfect case in point. Brilliant man, great credentials, but not a lot of background when it came to operating and managing a department like Department of Energy, and I think he's been subjected to a lot of criticism for that.
Senator Murkowski says she's met Jewell before at a cocktail party.
We talked about going hiking together. She strikes me as that kind of a person, somebody that is very easygoing, very unpretentious.
But that does not mean a yes vote is guaranteed. She worries Jewell could be too sympathetic to the environmental community. Before the full Senate can vote on a nomination, Jewell needs to pass a vote in the Energy Committee. If that happens, Senator Mark Begich does not know how he'd vote.
I am not going to just blankly support her because the president wants a person in that position.
Begich, who was on a cell phone from the Democratic Senate retreat in Annapolis, says he's withholding judgment until he gets to know where Jewell stands on key issues like Arctic drilling.
The president has already said that that is a policy that they're moving forward on in development of the Arctic, but if the Interior Department Secretary isn't supportive or slows down the process, then that would be very problematic.
Senator Begich also appreciates that Jewell has been in the private sector. Before REI, she worked in commercial banking and out of college in the oil fields of Oklahoma and Colorado for Mobil. She's been active in elections, giving money to many candidates. She's mostly donated to Democrats, including a $250 contribution to Senator Begich in his 2008 run. She also gave $500 to Senator Murkowski in 2009. Absent from her donor list is Congressman Don Young. He says he's disappointed in the pick because he does not think she has an understanding of public lands issues.
I do believe her interests lie in recreational purposes and other multiple use of the lands.
The oil and gas industry is keeping relatively quiet. John Felmy is the chief economist at the American Petroleum Institute. He says he welcomes a fresh start at Interior.
Well, we've had some differences with Secretary Salazar. We've had some onshore leases that have been pulled back. We're disappointed in that because we think we have an enormous amount of oil and gas that we can develop. We'd like to move forward as fast as possible.
Felmy would not say whether API would intervene in the confirmation process with an ad campaign or publicly oppose the nomination. Some environmental groups are excited about the pick. Cindy Shogun directs the Alaska Wilderness League. She says Jewel's hardest task will be fighting against strong support for Arctic drilling.
She wants to make her mark. She's going to have to make sure that she has the support of the delegation or is willing to make decisions that will disappoint them.
There is no date set for the confirmation hearings. It could be as early as next week, though that's unlikely. After that, the Senate is on recess until the last week of February. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The summer cruise ship season is like Christmas for a lot of coastal retailers, and they depend on the tourist income to stay open. But because the stakes are high, business has the potential to get dirty. For the first time, the state of Alaska is cracking down on third-party contractors that are allegedly treating local stores unfairly. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports from Juneau.
It's a winter afternoon, and the Mount Juneau Trading Post is quiet. Four carvers are up in the loft area working on masks, and the only other person in the store is at the cash register. But in the summertime, tourists pack the store to buy Bentwood boxes, drums, and soapstone figurines. Jack Tripp is the owner, and it's a point of pride for him that the Trading Post doesn't need to advertise with cruise ships to get their business.
The store's been there for 45 years, so it's kind of a downtown institution, and it's the native Trading Post in town.
But Tripp says that in the past, he's been approached by cruise ship advertisers to see if the Trading Post wants to be part of their onboard shopping program. In exchange for a fee or a percentage of his sales, these third-party companies would advertise his business in store guides and in maps for passengers. They would also have their onboard representative, or port lecturer in industry speak, promote his store directly to passengers.
If you pay money, they'll pitch your business in a favorable light and steer customers your way.
I visited six stores in downtown Juneau, and Tripp was the only person who would speak about port lectures on tape. But the other store owners and employees still had plenty to say. A couple talked about the exorbitant fees they charged, running into the tens of thousands of dollars. One person described it as a kickback scheme. Others alleged that the port lecturers had a reputation for saying bad things about stores that didn't play ball with them. And a few explicitly stated that the reason they didn't want to talk on tape was because they didn't want these companies to blackball them, since so much of their business is dependent on tourism. Tripp, on the other hand, says he doesn't fault the cruise ships or even the advertising companies for a situation, quote, run amok. As an established business, he says he's never felt real pressure to buy into the arrangement.
But I could see if you were a more marginal store or you're in a highly competitive, like if you're selling T-shirts or jewelry where there's many, many options, it could be a very favorable tool to have the port lecturer talk about your store.
The darker side of port lecturer operations recently caught the attention of the state. On Monday, the Department of Law and the three Florida-based advertising groups that put port lecturers on cruise ships reached a settlement over unfair business practices. The agreement serves more as a warning than anything else, and it doesn't include any admission of wrongdoing from Onboard Media, the Royal Media Group, or the PPI Group. But it does require them to pay over $200,000 for future enforcement of the state's Consumer Protection Act. Ed Sniffen is an assistant attorney general, and he says that the agreement also creates mechanisms for monitoring the company's activity. Their port lecturers are now required to make video or audio recordings of their shopping presentations, and the Department of Law has the authority to request and analyze those tapes if they suspect that the contractors are lying to consumers about which stores have the best deals or have warranties on their items.
The big penalties will come down the road if we find that there are violations, and if that's the case and we become aware of them, there are penalties of up to $50,000 for each violation that we can assess.
The settlement also lays out what qualifies as disparagement of businesses that don't participate in the Cruise Line shopping program. Port lecturers aren't allowed to suggest that stores that aren't part of their shopping program are risky or unsafe, and they can't actively discourage passengers from visiting those stores. The state is also giving port lecturers a script to read about how they pick which stores to mention at the start of every shopping presentation. According to Sniffen, that's to make sure
they aren't misleading and they're not deceptive, and that there's full disclosure that these stores have actually paid to be featured in these programs, and some of them pay big commissions to the port lecturers and the shopping ambassadors that are giving these presentations on board the cruise ships.
In an email, Onboard Media stated that they were, quote, very pleased to have the standards they have always followed formalized through the settlement. The Royal Media Group and the PPI Group did not respond to requests for comment. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, neighbors in Anchorage want the city to protect their water rights.
I went to turn on the faucet in the morning to get things ready for breakfast, and air came out of the faucet.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Regardless of where you live, you've got a better shot at earning the Alaska Performance Scholarship by enrolling in the Alaska Native Science and Engineering program. ANSEP challenges students with classes that are necessary to earn the scholarship. ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
A Cessna 172 owned by the Kuskokwim School District crashed on the Kuskokwim River yesterday. The pilot and both passengers were injured in the crash. KYUK's Mark Earhart has more.
Alaska State Troopers report the crash happened just before 5 p.m. yesterday, just after takeoff from the Kalskag Airport. Trooper spokesperson Beth Ibsen says little is known about the cause of the crash, but weather may have been a factor.
While trying to fly the river, the airplane crashed onto the ice-covered river, causing it to flip over.
Ibsen says responders from Upper Kalskag, including medical personnel, were at the scene.
Those injured in the crash were pilots, 44-year-old Steve Bruckner of Antioch, and his two passengers, 55-year-old Brian Foley of Antioch and 55-year-old Roy Gernsney of Anchorage.
All three suffered undisclosed injuries and had to be medevaced, Ibsen says. Gersney was flown to Providence Medical Center in Anchorage, while Bruckner and Foley were flown to the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta Regional Hospital in Bethel. Bruckner and Foley are Kuskokwim School District employees, while Gersney is a contractor for the school district, says District Superintendent Brad Allen. Allen says Bruckner and Foley were treated and released, and Gersney is still receiving medical attention in Anchorage. Ibsen says Gersney is listed in stable condition. The case is being handed over to the National Transportation Safety Board today. In Bethel, I'm Mark Earhart.
The EPA has taken their Bristol Bay watershed assessment back to the drawing board for revisions. When finished, the assessment could become a basis for the EPA to veto the proposed Pebble Mine, but a final version of the controversial study now won't likely be completed until the end of the year. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
Prior to Tuesday, it had been a long time since the EPA has had anything to say about their assessment of the Bristol Bay watershed. In fact, since releasing a report last November that detailed major concerns raised during a review by a panel of experts, the EPA has refused to comment at all about the assessment or how the experts' concerns would be addressed. EPA Region 10 Administrator Dennis McLaren finally spoke about the assessment during remarks to a friendly audience in Anchorage Tuesday at the Alaska Forum on the Environment.
As I've said previously, we haven't made any decisions yet about how we will use the information in the assessment, and will not do so until it's finalized.
But finalizing the assessment is considerably off track at this point. It was supposed to be finished by the end of 2012, following the public and peer review process last spring and summer. McLaren told the audience that delays are necessary to incorporate revisions.
We intend to complete the assessment later in 2013 after this additional round of review and comment is completed. And our primary objective is to make sure that we have gotten the assessment right and are using the best available science.
The EPA is basically starting the review process all over again based on a forthcoming revised draft version with another public comment period and public meetings planned for the spring and another peer review to follow. He He wouldn't go into details, but McLaren did tell KDLG News that the EPA has addressed the issues raised by the first round of peer review, including the chief concern that the assessment is lacking any central purpose. Then there's the issue of the EPA basing its study on hypothetical mine scenarios. Senator Lisa Murkowski is one of many who've said this creates a fundamental flaw in the EPA's work, a criticism she reaffirmed Tuesday.
If you say that this is a major open pit mine, but in fact the project that Pebble might eventually advance is not an open pit mine, then to me that's a pretty flawed study. You're basing it on an assumption that does not exist.
Those sentiments have long been voiced by the mining companies themselves. Mike Heatwell is a spokesman for the Pebble Limited Partnership.
You know, the peer reviewers in their comments sure had some critical things to say, especially around the use of the hypothetical mining scenario. And, you know, it really almost seems like they're spending more time trying to fix a flawed report than they spent trying to get it out the door in the first place.
The mining companies view the assessment as a step by the EPA towards shutting down operations before a plan has been submitted or permits applied for.
We're really being put through, you know, a process here that no company really in the history of the country has had to go through in advance of permitting.
But the many groups lined up against Pebble hope the EPA does use its authority under the Clean Water Act to veto the mine, and the sooner the better. These groups continue to support the EPA's work and have stated that the delayed process shows the EPA's commitment to getting the science right in this high-stakes assessment. Watch for another round of spirited debate coming this April. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
A group of homeowners in Anchorage's Rabbit Creek neighborhood are concerned that non-residential development could drain their water supply. They are suggesting an amendment to Title 21, the city's land use law, as a preventative measure. Members of the Anchorage Assembly are in the final stages of a 10-year rewrite of the law. It's been in the news for addressing issues like sidewalks and landscaping and stream setbacks. But according to Rabbit Creek residents, if it goes through without addressing water issues, the municipality could face problems down the road. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
Beth Glatfelty, her husband, and three kids moved to the Rabbit Creek area in 2005. Largely because they believed it was the perfect place to raise a family and chickens. The chickens live in a refurbished Connex container beside Glatfelty's 1952 homesteader log cabin on the lower hillside. There's lots of open space. On a clear day, she can see all the way across Turnagain Arm to Hope.
We love living in this area because of the rural aspect. We are on large lots, 2.5 acres in general, and we have a wonderful view and wonderful neighbors, and it's very remote yet close to Anchorage for all the amenities that Anchorage provides.
In December of 2011, just before Christmas, something happened that got her concerned about her water.
I was home with my kids. They were on Christmas break, and I went to turn on the faucet in the morning to get things ready for breakfast, and air came out of the faucet.
The water started flowing normally again after a few days, but after asking around the neighborhood, Glatfelty found out that many of her neighbors connected to the same aquifer as a nearby church well had similar problems that day. In all, 6 wells were drained, she says, and one went permanently dry.
That is when we banded together as a neighborhood to figure out what exactly had happened. And the more we found out, the more frightened we got, and the more we needed to probe and push and request protection from the city.
The church ran a drawdown water test that day in December because they were planning an expansion. They ran the water at 5 gallons a minute for 24 hours. The church has since dropped the idea of expanding, but as a result of their experience, Glatfelty and her neighbors have requested an amendment to Anchorage's Title 21 land use law, protecting residential neighborhoods from large non-residential establishments that could harm their water supply. Dane Havard is a pastor at Rabbit Creek Community Church. Havard says they've tried to expand 3 times since 2004. Each time, the neighbors appealed their applications to build. He admits he's also concerned about the hillside's water supply, and not just for non-residential development.
I do understand what their question is. I don't think it's really about a particular type of use. I think the claim was that the kind of use that we had in mind would somehow or another have a greater impact on the water than residential use. I think that's where we have a difference of opinion. And if the city or the state continues to allow residential development, the same issues are there.
Nancy Pease with the Rabbit Creek Community Council says that's a real concern.
It's anecdotal, but we do hear about people who have had to drill a second well, or in the case of my next door neighbor, had to use some sort of hydro fracking to enlarge the little seams that feed his well, which is in bedrock. And I believe there's at least one subdivision, the South Park subdivision, which was on a community well, and they tapped into the city water supply when their community well wasn't adequate.
He says the hillside has some of the largest tracts of undeveloped land in the municipality. Yet there's not been much mapping of the aquifers. And there are places where the water table is very low or is accessed only through small seams in the bedrock, she says. Pease worries that could spell trouble without some protections for residents in Anchorage land use law.
And in these areas, there may not be enough water to build out to the full density that it's zoned for. And there certainly may not be enough water to support more intensive uses such as schools or group living or churches, the kinds of uses that take a lot more water, at least periodically, than a single residential home.
But Assemblymember Debbie Osiander, who chairs the Title 21 Committee, says the amendment is unlikely to be included. She says she forwarded the request for an amendment to a municipal board that handles water and wastewater issues, but they haven't gotten back to her yet. She wants the board to send her wording for the new code. Osiander says Friday is the deadline for all amendments to Title 21 to be turned in to the Assembly. The Assembly will take their final vote on Title 21 February 26th. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the 2013 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence Program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority was created by the Alaska State Legislature to develop, stimulate, and advance the economic welfare of the state and further the development of public transportation systems. The authority has completed required environmental work to date, and the Federal Highway Administration has given its approval needed to move forward. There's more information at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Alaska state troopers say a human skull was discovered on a beach near Tuxuk Bay this past September. The skull has been examined by archaeologist Stephen Street with the Association of Village Council Presidents. Street determined it could be from one of the nearby ancient grave sites in the old village of Umgumyut. Troopers say a Tuxuk Bay priest buried the skull on Tuesday. Tuxuk Bay is one of three villages on the Nelson Island along the Bering Sea. The second running of the Paul Johnson Memorial Norton Sound 450 Sled Dog Race began today at noon. The race follows the historic Portage Trail from Unalakleet to Caltag and back and continues on to the finish line in Nome. Last year, during the inaugural running of the race, the top five teams got stuck in the middle of Norton Bay when they encountered ice ridges that they could not maneuver around. But trail conditions look much better this year. KNOM's Lorelei Kinnean has the story.
While the field for the second running of the Norton Sound 450 is small with eight teams, it is highly competitive. With a surprise late entrance of reigning champion Pete Kaiser from Bethel, he just decided to fly in a few days ago after getting his Iditarod drop bags organized. Returning mushers include Didi Johnro and Aaron Burmeister. Burmeister brings with him the strong team that took second place at the Cusco 300 last month. The rest of the field is new to the Paul Johnson Memorial, but not necessarily new to this trail. For example, John Rowe convinced four-time Iditarod champion Martin Boozer to ship his dogs to compete in the 450-miler. She told him the race was better than the Iditarod and was a highlight of her racing season last year.
You know, last year, those of us that came out here and then raced in Iditarod, we did very well. We had strong finishes. There were three top 10 finishers out of the Paul Johnson field last year. So that's why I'm back here, because I had such a good result by doing so.
Race organizer Mitty Johnson is brother to the late Paul Johnson, the musher and man the race is in memory. Johnson said his brother wanted to see a quality event take place, and his brother's vision inspires him and other race volunteers today.
He's encouraged us to strive for better and bigger things at times, and to, I think, just knowing that even though we're from a small village or other people are from small villages, that they can put their mind to things that they want to do.
The mushers left Unalakleet, the heart of the Norton Sound, at noon today for the 90-mile trip to Caltag, where they will most likely rest a bit before returning back for another rest here in Unalakleet. Race competitors include Didi Jonro, Martin Boozer, Jerry Willemitzer, Pete Kaiser, Aaron Burmeister, Alex Oten, Elliot Anderson, and Chuck Schaefer. The finish is expected Saturday in Nome. Reporting in Unalakleet for the 2013 Paul Johnson Memorial Norton Sound 450, I'm Lorelei Kinneen.
Yukon Quest race officials have extended the mandatory 36-hour layover in Dawson City by 4 hours. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, it's the second major change to this year's race.
The next stop on the Yukon Quest Trail is Eagle. Race personnel in the tiny Alaskan community are scrambling to get their checkpoints set up in time for the frontrunners. Race Marshal Doug Grillo says limited access there further complicates race logistics.
The window of a couple hours is just too tight to make sure those first teams had the proper services.
Grillo announced the additional time just as Eureka musher Brent Sass arrived in Dawson late Tuesday night.
I didn't really push him real hard, which was good, but it would have been nicer to know that before I left Pelly.
Two Rivers musher Abby West didn't know about the additional layover time either. She was surprised when the race marshal told her the change was necessary because teams, including hers, were moving so fast.
Oh! I'm not fast, am I? I'm slow, aren't I?
You're okay.
No. I felt slow.
But Wes doesn't mind the change.
I get to take that many more showers and go to sleep that much longer and eat more hamburgers or whatever they're going to feed me here. And I'm sure the dogs could use, dogs could always use extra little rest.
Mushers will reevaluate their strategies to account for the added rest time. They're also looking at a reroute of the trail into Eagle that eliminates an impassable American Summit and shaves 50 miles from the race. On the Yukon Quest Trail in Dawson City, I'm Emily Schwing.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Mark Earhart in Bethel, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Lorelei Kinneen in Unalakleet, and Emily Schwing in Dawson City, the Yukon. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. If you're interested in serving on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council, the deadline to apply is Monday, February 18. The councils provide information to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. For more information on the advisory councils and how to apply, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Regardless of where you live, you've got a better shot at earning the Alaska Performance Scholarship by enrolling in the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. ANSEP challenges students with classes that are necessary to earn the scholarship. ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.